Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And we are literally going through the primary source documents. So just to help you understand, because most people, believe it or not, I not everybody has gone to college and not everybody has spent a lot of time. Now, people in certain disciplines of professions and so forth do understand the importance of academics and academic writing, as well as academic standards. And in the field of medicine, many times when they do studies and so forth, they do these scientific and academic reviews, or I should say studies. And typically when somebody writes a paper, you know, based on a study, they have these peer reviews and those types of things to ensure, you know, its authenticity, worthiness, so forth and so on. And so there's a lot of effort in trying to create an academic document, an academic document that at least cites everything. And what a person like myself who does these things needs to do is you need to kind of peel yourself away so that you're not really casting judgment. But in many ways and many times, you're kind of forced in this position to literally start looking at how you're interpreting that information so that people might be able to garner the same conclusions. If you do not provide people conclusions, there's many times that they won't be able to do that themselves. And I say that because, you know, they're not thinking about it. Or they may look at it, because we're all different. And so the whole point is that you present the data, you present the facts, you present your thesis, this is what I believe, or this is what I'm asserting, and you let people basically come at you. Now, there are some points in time when you do this, and people don't understand what is literally the standard for what we would call a primary source document. Now, in doing this, you know, because I'm writing this article that actually highlights how the Federalist Papers are the poisonous pill that deliberately undermined and was the sole source of the subversion and perversion of the government that we have today, because it empowered the judiciary in ways that the Constitution never granted those roles, responsibilities, and powers to the judiciary. So the judiciary is acting so far out of scope, and how they got there was the Federalist Papers. And so how do I prove academically that the Federalist Papers should never have been used and should never have seen the light of day as a source document? Well, when you start looking at what are the conventions of, you know, academic standards, and we also have to include legal standards. So I'm kind of doing that as well, because we're talking about a legal document or a contract, a compact, which would fall under contract law. So I kind of created this, you know, background of how I have, you know, a long, long time ago, I just knew that this was the way to go. And lo and behold, as I've done all the research, it proves that I was right. Now, you know, I'm a lucky guy. In some ways, you know, I do things, and as a matter of fact, you know, if good is going to happen, the sun will shine on me. I'm just lucky when I make a decision and things like that. And I, you know, I had some longtime friends said, "Oh, the luck of Mobley. Oh, yeah, there it is. There's the luck of Mobley." And, you know, I would just say that maybe the Lord bless me, what have you. But in this particular case, I knew that the Federalist Papers had no true academic, no argument in why they were to be used by the court or the judiciary. Why? Because they were just editorials printed in newspapers. And, you know, I'm starting to hear this feedback coming back from other people now. They're probably, yeah, you know what? Those do not deserve the level of stature that they've received from the courts. So what are the primary source documents legally? Because I kind of went through academically what are primary source documents, you know, and then I've focused it more on what are the primary source documents regarding legal issues or legal matters. And then I went into, and by the way, every time you do a search, AI is going to give you basic generic information. You can always dive more and get more into it and really unleash the full power of AI, and I'll tell you, stay away from that crap. But AI will always give you this, you know, what you're going to get as the summary of your search, unless you're really looking for something very specific. But when it comes to things like this, these really standard conventions for academic, legal standards, so forth and so on, I was not surprised to find out that, you know, AI got it right. And as I progressed from what, you know, what are primary source documents for an academic paper, or what primary source documents for kind of a legal paper, and what is a primary source document for a, what is a legal primary source document, academic and legal documents for a contract. The primary source document that AI comes up with, and when you understand the tenets of contract law, and when you understand that the first question out of the judge's mouth, at least in the old days, was what did you agree upon? You know, and you could actually produce a paper that actually says, so this is the contract. But the judge would say, okay, but what did you agree upon? How did you stipulate? How did you define? Did you do anything more than the contract itself in executing this? Was there any stipulations, any clarifications in the accepting process of the contract? Because all of those factors are tied to that compact or that contract. And so when we look at the Constitution, the ratification debates are those primary source documents. Next, the next documents that actually have any position academically and legally would be the notes on the convention. And so we kind of started this off, and I told you, and I'll get it up there where you can actually look at Max Farrand, I think that's his name. We'll get Max Farrand's notes where he includes Madison and everybody else, anybody and everybody under the sun that was in the convention that wrote some notes regarding the very specific issue. It was a couple of days, because you'd be surprised, Yates had a couple. And as a matter of fact, come to find out, Yates's was post facto. In other words, he was recalling much later. It wasn't like they were official. They were more of a recall than actually sitting back in the room or in the room writing notes. There's a big difference now, folks, because if you're recounting a decade plus after the fact of what was said and how it was said and where it was said and by whom and blah, you know, all of those types of details, your accuracy literally becomes under question. So anyway, so this article, I'm trying, and I have to do this up front. So when I publish this, please forgive me for going through this painstaking process of explaining why this is all important. Because these are the recognized standards. And in the public opinion, the last thing you'll ever hear a reporter say, the last thing you'll ever hear a progressive say is, well, what are the standards? And as a matter of fact, I've seen this over the election discussions where the progressives have been asserting, and I get into these conversations and I quickly have to back out because they're saying, oh, you know, I actually had a conversation recently on social media with a guy that was responsible, supposedly, he's claiming credit of creating the systems that are being used or being involved in those systems that are being used in the mail-in ballot-only states like Washington. And so he piped up, you know, we don't have to worry about the elections in these all mail-in ballot states because they're the most secure and they have the best voter integrity and election integrity, period, bar none. And I had to say, I have to tell you, that's not true. It's not true at all. And so he points out, well, have you realized, you know, my background because I'm involved in these specifically. And then I go, okay, that's fine. And now I'm talking to a person or a horse that is not thirsty for water. They're not interested in anything I have to say. So why would I want to go further down that? But the fact is that anybody that says that they have a secure computer, because I'm not a turnip that falls off of a truck, at least not in this particular case. I kind of have worked pretty, you know, extensively with computer systems and so forth. And I've done that with, and as anybody knows me, and I talk about this, I've been in the intelligence community. And as a matter of fact, I know for a fact, and this, you can go to the Spying History Museum, wherever that is. I know NSA has one. And there's all sorts of places where you can find artifacts that were used and discovered as spying technology and spying, you know, equipment and so forth. I know for a fact that we have been building computers to allow to be snuck out, to be procured by our enemies or those people who we want to spy on, and literally give them these computers and get actionable and real intelligence from them, because they have no idea how these computers are spying on them. And this was back in the 80s. And we're not just talking about, you know, the PC. We're talking about, you know, very sophisticated computers. The point is this, that we now live in an age where there is not one computer out there that is not spying on their user. And these election systems are no different. They're more than capable. And anybody that tells you they're incapable of spying on you, then they're just blowing smoke. Because they're either ignorant, they really don't know what they're talking about, because I'm going to share this with you, folks. You don't have to have a battery or energy present in a series of components to be able to spy on somebody. You can create an active microphone by running an electronic stream, such as like a microwave or some stream of an electrical frequency, projecting it through a room that goes and basically transmits through this equipment that turns it on and has it function as a microphone. And in that same transmission, it actually picks up the audible, what the microphone is now sensing. Now we've got a microphone working, because a microphone just sitting on your desk, the crystal may be bouncing around, but it's not transmitting anything, and the crystal may be functioning, but it's not doing anything. But once it gets this energy going through it, it's capable of transmitting the conversations in that room. That technology goes back to the 80s. And people want to tell me that these things are secure. And folks, don't believe anybody. And as a matter of fact, I'll lay it out there. I'll bet my life on the fact that if we went back to the manner of our elections, using the same manner that the framers used in 1789, there's no way we would get the same outcomes, period. And as a matter of fact, every election would drastically change dramatically. And I'm not talking about keeping people from voting because they had, you know, poll tax and those types of things. No, no, no. Let everybody vote that gets there. You still have to be there on election day. That means you can only vote once, and the election occurs once. The sheriff would execute the election, and you got to be there during that time. And once the election's done, it's done. And I'm telling you that the outcome would be dramatically different, because the standard manner back in those days was via voca. In other words, the sheriff, instead of having people, you know, muster through the entire crowd, would ask, how do you vote for your congressional representative? And it would give you the candidates, and then the people would just respond by name. And he would write their name down, and this is how they voted. And people are just basically going, what about the privacy? There is no right to privacy in voting. That was not one of the things. As a matter of fact, it was always open that people was, you know, able to see. The only time that we started wanting privacy was when the evil people, the communists, the secularists, the godlessness, those people wanted to be able to start obtaining better privacy so that they could get the people in that would never have gotten in had we actually, you know, had open elections and so forth. Because then we could actually start holding those people who voted for these people that should, even though they may be on the ballot, they won't, because we've got this happening today. We've got people voting for people that are going to knowingly violate their oath. And they know that if we vote these people in, they'll violate their oath and nothing will happen to them. In other words, this accountability, because we're not holding people accountable, is just, it's lipstick on a pig. I can come up with a lot of different metaphors. Until we start holding our public servants to their oaths, we're not going to get any different. We're not going to get the outcomes we need. And so if we actually went back to these processes that this nation had, because, you know, why do you care? Why do you need to have a private vote when your representative can only play politics on those things enumerated within the Constitution? What's so special about whether that person be a man, woman, or their race, or anything else? I can understand maybe a long time ago when, you know, the women wanted to vote for women only, but, you know, we all presume that they did that, maybe, but that didn't mean that all women did that. Anyway, my point is this. This is tying it all to this. It's tying all to full compliance of the Constitution solves our problems. Having full accountability to the oath of office solves our problems. And actually having a system that is open and honest where we get rid of this secrecy, because states are hiding behind this veil of secrecy. Oh, well, you can't see these computers because you'd know how somebody voted and you're violating their constitutional rights. And folks, there is no constitutional right for you to be able to cast a secret vote. Show it to me. Show me where that is an inalienable right. As a matter of fact, I believe in heaven, everybody would openly answer, I cast my vote this way, because there are no secrets. Everybody probably knows what everybody's on, you know, will probably even see the thoughts. Oh, this guy's thinking of chocolate cake. Forgive me. You know, sometimes I, you know, believe levity's important. But, you know, I think we're, you know, in those types of circumstances, we're so transparent as people or as beings. Why would we want secrecy other than for evil to hide? That's all. And we started feeling sorry for these evil people that were complaining. And I mean, remember that if you weren't Christian in good standing, you could not have your day in court because the court could not trust you. This was America back in the days of Jefferson, even up to Story. Story talks about this in his commentaries on the law, that only good, you know, active Christians, or I should say Christians who were, you know, basically identified as, what was the term? They were active in their community as Christians. In other words, they were going to church on a regular basis. And this was a report that was given by the sheriff. If you read Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, he points out that the sheriff had identified a man that not being in good standing with his church in his community. There was no, he didn't go to any church you know, worships or anything like that. So in other words, he was not Christian. He was considered a heathen. And Story even talked about those things as well. But this was in Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. So, folks, I'm just telling you, if we go back to this old system, then I think things would start actually working out on their own. Welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
No, thank you for having the patience for this little rant, because bottom line, the whole point that I'm trying to really just reiterate and reiterate and reiterate is the fact that it's all about accountability. Understanding what the Constitution says and holding people accountable to those things, to those definitions. So, anyway. Anywho, so we're almost out of time, but what we're doing is we're reading Madison's notes, and actually we've kind of moved and jumped forward. And folks, so for those of you that are reading, we're on Wednesday, June 13th. We're on page 64 at the bottom in the highlighted section, because it's the only highlighted section on page 64. And it starts off with, on Mr. Randolph's propositions. So in other words, this is where the committee reports to the committee of the whole, or the body of the whole, in other words, all of the delegates. They're going through what this subcommittee went off and kind of created some changes and incorporated some stuff. And now they're kind of going through that and reading through that and identifying, you know, these further things that were presented. So go ahead and just start reading off with resolved, the number one resolved, the second, third, and fourth resolves. Go ahead and go through those. Thank you so much.
Resolved that it is the opinion of this committee that a national government ought to be established, consisting of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary. Number two, resolved that the national legislature ought to consist of two branches. Number three, resolved that the members of the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states for the term of 3 years to receive fixed stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, to be paid out of the national treasury, to be ineligible to any office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States, except those peculiarly belonging to the functions of the first branch, during the term of service and under the national government for the space of 1 year after its expiration. Number four, resolve that the members of the second branch of the national legislature ought to be chosen by the individual legislatures, to be of the age of 30 years at least, to hold their offices for a term sufficient to ensure their independency, namely 7 years, to receive fixed stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, to be paid out of the national treasury, to be ineligible to any office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States, except those peculiarly belonging to the functions of the second branch, during the term of service and under the national government for the space of 1 year after its expiration.
Okay.
Resolved.
So right there, they kind of recap what the plan was, but they've incorporated some of these changes, right? And so in four, how are these people chosen? How are the senators in that second branch, how are they being chosen?
By the legislatures.
Correct.
Of the states.
Correct. And in the House of Representatives, they're elected by the people. So by this point in time, they've kind of galvanized what was considered the Roger Sherman Compromise, the Connecticut Compromise, where they divided this. So we're going into break. So when we come back, we'll dive into what they kind of covered here, or at least I'll try to wrap up, you know, how they're kind of adapting to the arguments and everything else, and how they've been voting as a body of the whole and so forth, and how the Constitution is beginning to form. So we'll be right back. I mean, it's still got a long ways to go, but we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so kind of as we're looking at this, they're still working in the big picture. And so they're adjusting to how, as they've chewed on like the House of Representatives. Originally, that was going to be all the state legislatures that did that. Now they kind of, they're going to be elected by the people, and that the Senate was going to be elected by the state legislature. They haven't pounded out the roles and responsibilities. So at this point in time, I don't think that the Sherman plan was finalized, because we're about a day, maybe a week away from that happening. The New Jersey plan and then the Sherman plan. And as I look, actually the Sherman plan comes in the, in 2 days. And let me see here. I thought that we had the New Jersey plan. I'm not seeing it, but it's in here somewhere. If not, we may have missed it. And so, folks, if we missed it, go back and read it. Anyway, but you're seeing how this is not the form, like 3 years for a representative, 7 years for a senator. We know that there's going to be changes. But the whole point is we wanted to show you what the original presentation was and now what the new changes to it. We're not going to do this every week or every 2 weeks when they start going through this as the committee of the whole of what they agreed upon until much later. But going through and showing how they have evolved and what it evolved to in just a short period of time, I think is pretty good. Pretty important, too. So go ahead and continue with the fifth resolution and on.
Resolved, number five, resolved that each branch ought to possess the right of originating acts. Number six, resolved that the national legislature ought to be empowered to enjoy the legislative rights vested in Congress by the Confederation. And moreover, to legislate in all cases to which the separate states are incompetent, or in which the harmony of the United States may be interrupted by the exercise of individual legislation, to negative all laws passed by the several states contravening in the opinion of the national legislature, the Articles of the Union, or any treaty subsisting under the authority of the Union. You want to make some comments on that or not?
You know what? I will. Thank you. In the sixth resolution, the line that says, and moreover, to legislate in cases to which the separate states are incompetent. At this point in time, they're kind of creating a general constitution. In other words, they haven't come across the idea of providing very specified powers. So once they do, that line really goes away, because then Congress will only have the authority to create laws over these powers, period. They don't have to say that the states are incompetent. And that means that when they create these laws, that these laws will be the supreme law of the land. So the supremacy clause will kick it in without having to tell the states that they're incompetent, because you don't want to insult people. You're actually the service industry. You happen to have supreme authority over these very few things. And that's it. Everything else, the states are superior in all things else. Okay. So go ahead.
Right. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that it's not saying that the states aren't able or whatever or incompetent in the sense that we think of it today, but in the sense that that's not something that they would be able to do.
Right. And the concept of being able to negate laws passed by the several states contravening in the opinion of the... So at this point, it's just in their opinion. What ends up happening is that they can only contravene or they can only stop a state from legislating or creating a law when it violates their powers or the supremacy of their laws. And that's it.
Right.
So in other words, it's not left to debate or deliberation or subjectivity. It is very clear. Did you create a law regarding not repelling invaders when the Constitution clearly requires every invader be repelled?
Quite apropos, sir.
Okay, there we go. So so anyway, let's pick up the next one.
Number 7, resolved that the rights of suffrage in the first branch of the national legislature ought not to be according to the rule established in the Articles of Confederation, but according to some equitable ratio of representation, namely in proportion to the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age, sex, and condition, including those bound to servitude for a term of years, and 3/5 of all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, except Indians not paying taxes in each state. Number 8, resolved that the right of suffrage in the second branch of the national legislature ought to be according to the rule established for the first. Number 9, resolved that a national executive be instituted to consist of a single person to be chosen by the national legislature for the term of 7 years, with power to carry into execution the national laws, to appoint to offices in cases not otherwise provided for, to be eligible a second time, and to be removable on impeachment and conviction of malpractices or neglect of duty, to receive a fixed stipend by which he may be compensated for the devotion of his time to public service, to be paid out of the national treasury. I kind of like that better than what we have now.
Yeah, I get
except
that.
Except for the national legislature choosing them, but the part about impeachment, that's way more clear and apropos of our last administration.
Yeah, so actually the Constitution changed it to where each house had the ability, the judiciary, the Senate, and the House of Representatives kind of maintained and managed their own, you know, policing, which basically led to the creation of a den of thieves and the honor among thieves.
Yeah.
Okay. Which, down the road, the 14th Amendment, Section 3, alleviated that and said, you no longer have the ability. Now you must hold each other accountable. The problem is that we've never woke up and said, hey, you guys got to hold each other accountable, and we're going to start holding you accountable because you're not. So, I mean, it has to be initiated by us, folks. It has to be.
May I have a sidebar?
Yeah.
Could you explain, please, the filibuster? I mean, in context of what's going on right now with the SAVE Act and the shutdown over the funding of the ICE, it needs continuing another continuing resolution, but specifically the filibuster in the Senate. What is that all about?
Well, so the filibuster, technically, I mean, have you ever seen somebody do a filibuster?
I've seen performative foolishness.
Okay. So
I've never seen anybody like it's never been a. It's always been politically motivated about narrative and agenda. It's never been about the context of the law that they're trying to pass or whatever the issue is.
Okay, so a filibuster is perceived, it can be perceived, because if you look it up, it can be perceived as, you know, an engagement of war against, you know, an entity, or, you know, basically stopping and seizing a body. And the filibuster is basically enabling a person to literally seize the full control over the body until they step down. And so, technically, do the citizens of the United States have the ability to filibuster any representative body?
I would think so.
They do. How would they be able to do that?
They can...
There's only one way, and it's in the Constitution. It's constitutionally protected. The
petition.
Right, there you go. The right of petition shall not be abridged. Right. So when you go in, you basically say, I am petitioning you for the redress of grievances. All things stop. They have to give you... Now, technically, if your county was smart, they would come up with a process that says, you know, please submit your petition, and then, you know, at the soonest point in time, we will, you know, have you come in, we'll schedule with you so that, you know, we can make it convenient for you and for us for you to provide your petition, and we will give you whatever time you need. Technically, you know, when that happens, when they actually have a process, they can keep you from just walking in and taking over. But they have to do it in a timely manner. In other words, they can't, you know, if you submit the petition on Monday, they can't wait a month from now. They have to go and look at their schedule and say, okay, we need to make the time for this, and whatever is a reasonable time. Because if they basically stonewall you, then you can call them out for violating your rights, and this would actually get the people. This should actually alarm the people to stand up and say, either you recognize and honor this person's right of petition, or we're all going to descend upon you and filibuster you and take away everything you've got. You can try, because the right. So here we have what we call the right of what? Assembly, that is attached to the right of petitioning. The right of the people to assemble and petition their government for the redress of grievances shall not be abridged. That's not in that order. The right of the U.S. citizen shall not be abridged to assemble or petition their government for the redress of grievances. It's in that order. But technically, as we look at that, that means that if the people really support the... So if you're complaining about the the opaqueness, or the lack of the opaqueness of the paint that they're putting in the roads and dividing, that's not that big of a deal. But the whole right of petitioning for the redress of grievances can be about anything and everything you want. But when we make it about violations of the Constitution, this is literally calling them out of either failing to do their job, or, you know, having to, calling them to wake up and do their job, and or calling them outright that, you know, we're coming for you. You need to step down. You have violated, and we're not taking this. So it becomes a real message when you make a First Amendment petition regarding the redress for constitutional violations, which means that all of a sudden, now here's something that they better handle, and they better handle it quickly, especially if the people agree. So if the people agree in your county that this invasion must be dealt with, then going out and standing out and kind of running interference with these pink hairs and the pink, blue, and chartreuse hairs and whatever, I mean, whatever the colors are, your job and your constitutionally protected right is to get your butt into that county commissioner's in the county that this is happening in and demand that they get all hands on deck to get these people who are failing to actually support the Constitution. They may be citizens, but they're violating the law. You don't have a right to be out in the street to stop the enforcement of the Constitution. That's not a right. What that is it's called a rebellion against the Constitution. And that's actually covered in Section 3. Even though it doesn't apply to citizens, if you're committing a rebellion against the Constitution, then you're in position to actually lose your citizenship. I can't say this any plainer. The states and counties need to start standing up and saying these people need to have their citizenship revoked. And as far as we're concerned at this county, we're not going to allow or extend to them these privileges. But we need to get the state, because it's unfortunately, this is why if you had your county constitution, you could have given this power to yourself to make sure that if the state doesn't do it, you can still at least control your own inhabitants who are actually running a revolution against you. Does that make sense? And does that help? So let me get back to the filibuster. When it comes to the Senate, it's just a senator getting up there and stopping everything. And so I don't know what the record is where somebody's been doing it for 40-some hours, 60 hours. I have no idea. But I do know that all it does is it keeps the Senate from doing anything. And for the most case, when somebody does a filibuster, most of the senators leave. They don't stick around. They're holding the procedural process hostage. They don't hold the senators hostage, if that makes sense.
Well, none of it really makes sense at this point. But what my concern is why do they have to have 60 votes to pass this SAVE Act for the election integrity?
Why do they need to have 60 votes to pass the SAVE Act?
Yeah.
That's not a tall order, but whenever they have to pass, so this is something that Jefferson put in place that required almost anything and everything that they did require 60 votes. It's only that the Senate basically had attacked those procedures from, you know, being used when it came to filling, you know, the justices. So they've actually taken that down to where certain things don't require 60 Senate votes. The real problem isn't the fact that it's 60 Senate votes. Folks, the 17th Amendment did not take the state legislature's power from telling their senators, sit down, shut up, and vote for the SAVE Act. We don't want to hear anything from you. You vote for the SAVE Act. They have that power, and the Constitution demands it. And as a matter of fact, if you now have, because 60%, it's not necessarily 60 votes, it's 60% of the votes. Because they don't have to have full quorum to get the 60%. Does that make sense? In other words, if the blue states, or I should say the red states, start removing some of the blue senators, then it may actually change the numbers. But technically, the blue states need to pull any of these senators that are voting on their own accord and not based on how they want them to vote. The Constitution gives the authority to get rid of them and then to demand that they be replaced. And in other words, they would be able to remove them and then go to the governor and say, either you put somebody in there that's going to, you know, do what we tell them to do, or we're going to pull them out and you're going to have to replace somebody again. The Constitution guarantees our suffrage in the Senate. Folks, if you read the truth, my article called The Truth About the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment never took away the state's suffrage, the state legislature's suffrage in that Senate. It's that simple. So the filibuster's not the problem. Everybody believes the 17th Amendment's the problem, and it's not the problem. It's the state legislatures. And this is what I want to share. This is another rant. I sent this article, The Truth About the 17th Amendment, out to several state legislatures. I mean, somewhere around 20-some states. And these states are pretty much red. I didn't send this out to any blue states. But Arizona was on it. I made sure all the states that had senators that were falling underneath the Democratic umbrella, They all received it, Arizona, Georgia, so forth. And I told them that you have the ability to tell your senators, you have the constitutional authority to tell your senators how to vote. And if they refuse to vote the way you tell them, you have the authority to remove them for violating the Constitution. Because Article 5 demands that your suffrage cannot be taken away without your consent. And if your senator is up in D.C. denying you your suffrage, then you have the authority to remove them. What do they need to do?
Why do you think that the states don't enforce that?
Okay, so this is
some kind of one hand washes the other kind of deal, or
yes, kind of.
I don't understand why the states.
So here's the problem.
Allowed this to happen.
Here's the problem, because I brought this up with patriotic legislatures that I know, Wyoming, Montana, and I've been told Teresa Manzella and Bob Wharf and others out there that, you know, this we can't get this passed right now. It doesn't matter whether you can get it passed. You get the bill out there so that the people see it. Then the people will start changing the makeup of your legislature to get that done. Now, these two states really don't have, you know, senators that are out there rogue-like. Well, Wyoming is questionable, but Montana. But for the most part, we need to change the paradigm. And when a few states start doing this, if the Trump administration actually pulled up the Constitution and said, hold on here, I would be down in Georgia, I would be in Arizona, and I'd have to pull up all the other states that have, you know, like I think New Hampshire has one, and another one has another. And I would be in front of all of those state legislatures. I would actually zoom into that state, because they're all in session right now, my friends. I would zoom into that state, walk in, and basically command them to start following the Constitution. Or do we need to start removing you? And tell those senators how you want them to vote. They are constitutionally required to vote your vote. The only reason that because the suffrage is guaranteed to whom? The senator or the state legislature?
The legislature.
There you go. It's the same thing with the suffrage for your House of Representatives. If the framers during this Constitutional Convention could have understood technology and could have understood databases and algorithms and all these types of things, they could have actually created an electronic system that with your phone you'd have an app, and they would basically say, how do you want me to vote on this particular bill? And if they had active people that were using the app, they could go in and say, I want you to vote this way. Then they could it could tabulate precisely, you know, out of all their constituents, how many people, and if the constituent number that comes in is greater than 50% and they don't vote, then they're basically denying their representation. They're denying those who they represent suffrage, because they're there to vote for them. It's the suffrage of the people that they have to serve. The problem is that it's so, you know, well, how do we know? How do we do this? How do we know how many it is? We have the ability today to do this, folks, to tie them down and say, you will vote these ways. And as a matter of fact, if we have people that are deliberately telling their representatives to vote against the Constitution, like, do we repel the invaders and vote, you know, no, you vote against that, then all of those people that demanded that they vote against that should actually be suspended from being able to engage. Because when it comes down to telling your representatives to violate the Constitution, that's unacceptable. Because all citizens are required, legally required, to support and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. Folks, when you start peeling the onion back, there's only a couple of layers when you hit these things. When it comes down to who's obligated and what do they have to do. Everybody's obligated to support and defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. That's every citizen. You're not willing to do that, then you should be stripped of your citizenship. These aren't the post-Civil War days where, you know, blacks are being oppressed anymore. As a matter of fact, we've got way too many Karens out there that are being enabled. And I say that with all reservations on hurting anybody's feelings that's named Karen. I have to say that we have way too many people that we've been enabling bad behavior to demand that we want, you know, we want you to protect us. We want our protection. We want, you know, we want affirmative action. We want advantages for ourselves. Women want advantages. This particular demographic wants an advantage. Sorry. You're asking for the Constitution to give you something that it has no authority to do. Nobody gets advantages. And the bottom line is our government can only do those things that are enumerated. Quit asking it to do things that it does not have the authority to do. Ask your representatives to vote away that they shouldn't be voting, period. This would start waking people up. Oh, sure, I won't be able to vote in the next election because I did the wrong thing. I didn't know as a citizen I could do the wrong thing. Yeah. We got 2 minutes left. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's excellent. Okay. And I mean, I think it's just ridiculous that, and I saw a poll, it was like a composite, 71% of Democrats favor of ID to vote, and 95% of Republicans. So the majority, which you hardly ever get that.
Yeah.
The majority of public opinion wants this. And they're still playing these games. Schumer said yesterday, I think it was, that this is Jim Crow 2.0 and they're going to disenfranchise 21 million people and it's racial. And it's what he said is racist. That certain segments of the population can't get an ID. It's just outrageous.
Right.
And just like you were talking about with the specific carve-outs for different segments of the population and how the Constitution has no authority for that. And it's all part of an agenda.
Yep.
It just like the manipulating the voting and the suffrage.
Yep.
It's all part of an agenda. Absolutely. To destroy the country.
Right.
It's very plain to see.
Yes, and so, you know what? When we put aside these, I'll just say these matters that we, you know, if it's not there, it's not even worth arguing. The only reason that people keep arguing about it is because they actually get their way because we're living within a functioning democracy that is being ruled by a judiciary and an executive bureaucracies that, you know, are just pulling us asunder.
Very well said. Very well said.
So the day that people start giving up their democracy, like if you think that having voter initiatives in your state is good, you're crazy. Because it is democracy. We have to hold our public servants accountable to their oath and only deal with those things that are enumerated. And we need to hold them accountable and get rid of them when they cross the line. Just like citizens, you cross the line, you lose your citizenship, you can't vote. You continue to do it, we'll deport you if you want to escalate your crossing of the line. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.